This is TFR News. I am Matthew Plunkett, here with Joshua Burton.
Hello.
Like always, hope everyone's doing all right out there. Man, oh man, do we have a special episode for you today.
Oh my God, this was such a treat.
This was the first interview that we had conducted.
Yes, we had our channel.
On our channel, nobody else did, our own. And it was with the ever so pleasant Micah Hanks, who is I don't even know where to begin when I want to talk about Micah. He's like a ufological porn star, you know? He's he's just so beautiful. What a specimen.
Such a well-spoken man.
I don't think anyone could be that articulate and beautiful and not be created in a lab.
Maybe it was.
He might have been. That's the only explanation I have. But yeah,
he's always recording from a bunker underground, so.
That's true. Where is that bunker? Oh, he does say in Appalachia a lot. Anyway, yeah, we're
checks here. Out.
Yeah, you will be hearing in just a few moments our interview that we did with Micah Hanks, avid podcaster. You know, he has the Seven Ages about archaeology. He's got Sasquatch Tracks, which it's in the name. He's got the Micah Hanks program, which is typically about like technology and UAPs and such like that. He's got the Debrief. We go all over this in the interview, but we talk about our subject today. Being the new UAP whistleblower that has come out of the woodwork named David Grush. And the main reason why this gentleman is so notable and really captures the attention of anybody he's around is not only is he incredibly intelligent by how he structures his phrases, how he speaks and what he speaks about, but he's coming into this wave of a decades-long journey of changing the world and how they look at UAPs.
Yep.
All right? So Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal, who broke the story in 2017 about the black money project, you could say, of ATIP, when the government's like, no, we're not looking into UFOs whatsoever. Yes, they have been. And they broke that story. Well, it just so happens that these journalists came across, as for lack of a better term, they came across David Grush, basically, and he had some insider knowledge about what the government was keeping from Congress, yep. More or less. That's basically how you can look at it in a nutshell. But this information dealt with UAP crash retrievals. And does that mean objects is the size of football fields, which he does say in one interview, which makes me go, what? To little 3-foot in diameter, non-man-made craft, and
small
what they're
crafts made by non-human intelligence.
Nice,
helped you.
Nice, some gotcha. NHI there. I like that. But yeah, he's and other people he has named. His credentials have been backed up in his geospatial agencies, the National Reconnaissance Office, any and all of that checks out, which helps people like you and I and Micah as well keep their eyes, you know, attentive towards this person. Yeah. Kind of like, okay, I'll hear what you have to say. And it was so intriguing. It's so interesting. It's so almost baffling because you could say you've heard it all before.
Yeah.
But again, riding this wave now of what UFOs have become, UAP, and how it's being almost reintroduced into the world is captivating to say the least.
Yeah. And this is all coming from somebody who has nothing to gain but everything to lose.
Yeah, and that's one of the more credible pieces that's brought up about David Grush is the way he did it, the proper channels that he went through to dispel this brain fog that's been going around some of the government agencies about what's being kept mm-hmm. from them. And he's like, yo, I have the information. You need to know this. He's liable to be persecuted. He can go to jail. He can be tried for this. If it turns up that he is just making all this up.
So absolutely.
Why would someone who has nothing to gain do that to themselves?
Yeah, because you got to think, like, if this does come out, like, he made it all up, losing all your clearance, losing all of your credibility, your job, you're going to be looked at as a joke. So, really, like I said, everything to lose.
Yeah. Now, of course, there are some bigger kind of raising eyebrow moments. You know, you talk about people that, you know, the pilots of this craft and how they've been dead and that bodies have been retrieved. You know, that's a little more kind of like, all right, whatever. But how he speaks, specifically choosing non-human intelligence, but not saying extraterrestrial,
yep,
is one of the biggest takeaways. And again, we go over it in the interview with Micah Hanks. One of the biggest takeaways I take from this, because that's something I've actually never really looked at it too much myself.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you have John Keel and like ultra-terrestrials, you know, something that occupies Earth, but kind of in a different dimension, to say the least. But I never really gave any credence to that type of theory. I never really looked into it too much. I just thought, you know what? I don't know. It's a little bit easier for me to believe that something from outer space is coming rather than a different dimension. But after hearing this gentleman, you know, spew everything he's got, it makes me lean a little bit more to the ultra-terrestrial, or the one gentleman that Micah talks about that says like the crypto-terrestrials.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's an amazing interview with Micah. I'm sure you guys will love it. You know, we hope you love it, because why else would you be here?
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, without further ado, I guess we'll just go ahead and let the interview roll here. So we are here joined with Micah Hanks. Micah, thank you so much.
My pleasure. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Not too bad. How are you?
Well, I'm doing okay. I mean, it's been busy since the last time I saw the two of you. You know, and as you now know, there were moments, fleeting moments, where over the course of the weekend at Monster Fest, I would mysteriously vanish. And now you probably have a good idea of why I kept running back to my hotel room, having to take phone calls, carrying my laptop around with me, you know, looking at people with side-eye glances and things. There was a lot going on behind the scenes that now infamous weekend in Ohio.
I imagine it's nonstop for you, that you are a busy, busy man.
Yeah, that is true, actually. I mean, it's been a little too busy, frankly, because I came back from Monster Fest. The night I got back, you know, our good buddy Aaron Deese was traveling, not traveling with me, but he and I just so happened had the same flights back all the way to Charlotte. Then he went on to San Antonio from there, and I went on to Asheville. So he and I were essentially traveling together all day. And as you can ask Aaron, I mean, I was on the phone with the authors of this very big article, which I'm sure we'll be talking about here in a moment, that The Debrief published. I was on the phone with my cohort and my comrade and my principal co-founder, Tim McMillan. I mean, there was just so much going on. And then that night I got in and I was still working. I literally walked in the door, poured a Sprite. I didn't drink sodas, but I wanted something that had enough sugar to keep me awake and not enough caffeine to you know, keep me going all night. And yeah, so hit the ground running and haven't stopped really pretty much since I got back.
All right. Well, let's continue that. I don't want to give you a break just yet.
Of course.
So Micah, you're an avid podcaster. You have many shows, Sasquatch Tracks, Micah Hanks Program, creator, co-founder, editor of editor-in-chief, excuse me, at The Debrief. And I guess we could say between me and Josh and you that you are the director of the Golden Strike Force.
Yeah, although that's classified. I mean, you guys have the requisite clearance. The two of our wonderful, intrepid hosts, in fact, ladies and gentlemen, they are read into that. But that special access program is going to have to remain off the books for everybody else.
Yeah, no whistleblowers here about that.
Not yet.
Well, everyone, you know, thanks for tuning in to our first ever interview here. And Micah, thanks again, of course. You know, we followed the five WikiHow steps of trying to get someone on here, first by threatening his life, so there was nothing else he could do about it. I'm going to start off with just kind of simple, average, yet big question. But, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and the fascination that you've had with UAPs, just extraterrestrials and UFOs in general, and technology. Obviously, The Debrief is very heavily on technology. But yeah, tell us how that all kind of came to be and what keeps you doing it to this day.
Huh, man, that's a good question. So, and yeah, I'm not sure, you know, the three of us have even talked about this. You know, a bit of background for the listeners, you know, Matt and Josh and I have met at a couple of events. I think the first one was the wasn't Monster Fest. It was probably Cryptid Con down there in Kentucky. And then we were recently together up there in Ohio. And you know how it is at these conferences, you fall in with people, you make friends and everything. You just kind of go right into it. And then all of a sudden you're forming an elite strike force that is capable of deployment on a moment's notice and able to go out there and just, you know, tackle any challenges, anomalous or otherwise, that may occur in nature or perhaps even in other dimensions. We don't know. That said, My actual origin story when it comes to all this stuff goes back, I kid you not, to when I was about 4 or 5 years old. You know, I had parents who would always tell me stories about, you know, the unexplained UFOs and Sasquatch and things like that. And I recall in kindergarten having a knowledge of what a UFO was supposed to be and looking for them, mm-hmm. going to school and talking to other kids about that. You know, I have a recollection of having seen a light in the sky. It would have been in kindergarten, probably the second semester of like my first year in kindergarten. So I'm like 5, maybe 5.5 years old. And I remember going to school and telling a classmate, Brandy Wheeler, about this light I saw in the sky. And she, you know, playing the role of the skeptic, told me, oh, I know what that was. That was the Pizza Hut sign. They shine that in light, you know, line. Yeah, she probably made this up, but she's like, you shine that light in the sky to try and get people to come buy pizza. I'm like, Batman had one of those. I didn't know Pizza Hut got one. How can I get one of those?
So, oh, that would be killer.
I know, right? Yeah, the pizza signal. So, I mean, anyway, actually, God, that's a really good idea. And, you know, Gold Strike Force is going to need one of those too. But anyway.
Absolutely.
Third grade rolls around. I had a third grade teacher who was, you know, really science minded, and therefore she was quite the skeptic. And that was a good thing, ultimately. Mm-hmm. She told me, you know, I did a report on UAP, which back in those days, we still called them UFOs, but I did a book report on UFOs, and she allowed me to do it, but she was obviously conflicted about this. And she had me stand up in front of the class, and she took points off on the merit of the subject matter. And she essentially said, listen, you did a good job on your report, but you need to understand that, you know, we're here to talk about the real mysteries of space and science, not science fiction. I think that's how she termed it. And I know this because it's over in the other room there, but I still have the journal from that year. I believe it was 1994. I'm pretty sure. I still have my journal from that year where I am documenting, my progress. Okay. In class and, you know, all the things we're covering, we were charting like lunar phases and things like that. And in one of the entries, I note, hey, I just got this great new book on UFOs my dad gave me. And I even mentioned, I'm like, it's an inch thick. I thought this was really important that my dad gave me a book that was an inch thick. Wow, that's a lot to read, you know? And yeah, the teacher was like, okay, this is not good. But the assistant teacher, she was like secretly sending me messages, writing them in the margin. Oh, she's like, did you see Unsolved Mysteries last night? So, I mean, those early experiences showed me that, I mean, there are skeptics and then there are those who are kind of intrigued by all these things. And those early experiences put me somewhere in the middle. I was, you know, very influenced by my teacher who, although I pushed back against her, I did take the hint. I was like, okay, I see that we got to be scientific about this. We can't just accept crazy claims and things. But by the same token, I'm not just going to go quietly into the night, so to speak. You know, when she stood me up in front of the class and kind of made an example out of this, wow, isn't this kind of stuff that scientists look at, I said, okay, you know what? If they won't, then I will. And that led to a parent-teacher conference and all this stuff. And it basically came down to my parents saying, look, he reads. What's the problem? Yeah. So I'm very glad I had parents who defended, you know, my right, I think, as a child to be able to explore the topics that I was interested in. But the influence of that teacher, her name was Miss Hall. I'd love to try and find her if she's still around, you know, and tell her, you know. Yeah, you know, that, I mean, that was helpful. But long story short, I mean, that kind of is where the journey began. And so here we are today, and I still kind of have those same values in the sense that when we founded The Debrief, Tim McMillan and MJ Benias and I, you know, I approached him with this idea and said, I think this would be a really cool idea, a different way to report on UFOs. And Tim had said, well, but, you know, this has to be done in the context of science and technology. The problem is that UFOs are always out on an island by themselves. We should report on all this in the context of other things. And so, you know, 90% of what we cover there at the site, I mean, I'm covering space and launches. I'm covering physics, you know, and science. We're covering astronomy, defense. There's that other, you know, 5 to 10% of the stuff that's kind of the weird stuff, but we approach it from a very scientifically grounded perspective. And I think it's that ethos that brought this big story in recent days, you know, right to our table, kind of fell in our laps, and gave us a great opportunity to bring potentially, depending on how this all works out, potentially some groundbreaking news to the world.
I bet your teacher's probably like, wow, I fucked up. look at it now.
Probably has no recollection of me at this point, you know.
So, of course, this episode's about our new UAP whistleblower, David Grush. He came out not too long ago making all sorts of claims that, you know, for better or worse, I mean, there's a lot of, there's just a lot of credentials to it. A lot that's been proven, you know, he's worth looking into. Can you go a little bit into, for our listeners here, what this whole story is about and entails? Why is this so prevalent now?
Certainly. You know, I'll preface it, Matt, just by saying that, you know, there has been, I mean, for decades, there's been this kind of a rumor of there having been acquisitions by the United States military and perhaps other militaries around the world of non-human craft, right? Flying saucers. I mean, one of the most notable examples, it's not alleged to be the first. There are even earlier examples, and Grush has discussed these, but the best known probably is the incident involving Roswell, New Mexico in the summer of 1947, where Mac Brazel found this debris on his remote ranch and goes into town. He reports this to the local sheriff. Then Roswell Army Airfield was called in. Army Airfield, because at the time, this is right on the cusp of the establishment of the U.S. Air Force as a separate branch of the military. And if you think about it, I mean, the Navy is our oldest, and then the Army in 1947, right when all the really saucer craze begins, we established the Air Force. And then within just the last few years, we've also established the U.S. Space Force, the fourth branch of the military, and that roughly coinciding with all this UAP interest of recent years. So it's kind of interesting how there's a bit of a parallel there. All that said, I mean, we've been hearing these kinds of stories for decades. Now, what happened in recent days had been that, you know, there were already whispers about whistleblowers with alleged knowledge of all this coming forward. And that due in part to, in part thanks to the passage of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2023. In 2020, under the cognizance of the Department of the Navy, the UAP task force was officially established, but it really already existed. As I know from having spoken with the former director of that program, Jay Stratton, and other information that's now on the public record, there was a, as they termed it, a multi-agency task force looking at UAP that had existed for some time prior to its official sanctioning in 2020. And even prior to that, under David Norquist at the time, who I believe was the acting director or maybe the acting deputy director of the Department of Defense. I'd have to go back and check it, see exactly what his full title was. But Norquist directed the establishment of this, and the name itself, UAP Task Force, had appeared in bill language weeks prior to that. So it had already existed. Mm-hmm. And then its successor was for a very short period a thing within the DOD called the Airborne Object Identification Management and Synchronization Group, or AIMSOG.
Yeah. AIMSOG, yeah.
Pretty sure that was intentionally meant to be unpronounceable and not memorable. So Congress intervened, and this really being an effort that was spearheaded by U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, but also with support from Marco Rubio, Mark Warner, and a number of other senators, Ruben Gallegos on the congressional side and others. The House and the Senate agreed on a version of the NDAA. It was passed into law, and there was a provision, actually a amendment that was added, known as the Gillibrand Amendment, which basically directed the DOD to establish this office, to expand its scope, and it was renamed the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. So that's really what the DOD is looking into, and within the language of the 2023 bill, they expanded its authorities, basically, and one of the provisions had been for there to be protections for whistleblowers who might have knowledge of these kinds of things happening in government, so that if they do come forward, they won't be, you know, held liable, they won't be penalized for coming forward and talking about special access programs and things they may have knowledge of. So it's no surprise that we started hearing that there were some whistleblowers coming forward. My colleague Chrissy Newton had begun to become aware of some of these while she was doing some work in Washington, D.C. several weeks ago. And there were a few others who also began to, you know, catch wind of all this. Some of the names of some of these individuals had also leaked in recent days. And that's basically everything that was occurring immediately prior to me getting an urgent email from Leslie Kane, of course, one of the two authors of a 2017 article in the New York Times that revealed the existence of that informal Pentagon initiative known as ATIP.
It came out on my birthday.
Yeah, did it really?
December 16th. Hell yeah. What a gift that was.
Boy, yeah, no joke. I mean, it was a gift really to everybody, and I refer to it as the shot heard around the world. And it really was an article that fundamentally reshaped the debate on UAP, because for years the DOD had been saying, we are not involved in this. We don't look into this topic anymore. Whereas, in fact, as we now know, they sure as hell did. Now, Leslie and Ralph had been working on a follow-up. And if you recall, they published a few follow-ups in the New York Times. There was one in 2019 that revealed for the first time in name, Ryan Graves, who was a former F-A-18 Super Hornet pilot with the U.S. Navy. He and his squadron between 2014 and 2015 had encountered some of these objects off the U.S. eastern coast. And there were others, too. And then there was another follow-up that they did where they began to try and touch on this idea of crash wreckage retrievals, and they didn't really have that much to report at that time. But with the passage of the 2023 NDAA and the whistleblower provision, as these whistleblowers start coming forward, I guess in the great words of the dude, new shit has come to light. So in essence, what happened was Leslie reached out to me. The names of a couple of these whistleblowers had leaked on a podcast. And that podcast, actually one produced by our very own Chrissy Newton of the Debrief. It's called Rebelliously Curious. There had been a guest on her program who dropped a couple of names, and people online began kind of sleuthing. And unbeknownst to us at the time, one of those people was the primary source, Mr. Grush, in this article that Leslie and Ralph were writing. And at that time, they were working with the Washington Post. They had a senior author there with the Post who was working with them. And they had basically gone through the vetting process of all the different sources and things. They were still trying to get additional information from congressional staffers and stuff. When it became evident that the name of the whistleblower had leaked, the Washington Post was saying, well, we still want to take more time and we don't want to put this out quickly. Leslie and Ralph had been saying, well, we're going to lose the story if we don't put this out, because by, you know, next week, they, of course, knew that there would be interviews and things coming down the pike. And that ended up being the case. So they went to some other publications, and after unsuccessfully being able to work out a reasonable timeline that would ensure that the story was not lost, they came to us, and they'd actually been talking to us already. They actually came to us even before they went to at least one other large publication. My advice had been, you know, go to the biggest outlet that you can, because I've had tremendous respect for Leslie Kane for a number of years. And I said, you know, go where you think it will be the most impactful. But if we have an opportunity to publish it, I need to be able to get my team on this so that we can independently vet every single one of these sources ourselves. It was very swift work that we had to do, but we were very quick and very, after taking, you know, quick definitive action, I think we can say that we were very successful in being able to corroborate everything that Ralph and Leslie had reported, independently vet all of the sources. I had lengthy conversations by phone with both Ralph and Leslie. We were able to go over all the details. We were able to communicate with some staffers and people in Washington who had knowledge of this Inspector General complaint filed with the Intelligence Community Inspector General, and they were able to confirm to us that they, you know, had knowledge of this. And again, all these details are basically outlined in a series of interviews, a three-part interview that my colleague Tim McMillan did with one of our science writers, Chris Plain, there at the website, which we actually published that supplemental to this primary article so that everybody could kind of see what our research process was. Now, most of the response to the article was pretty good, and we'll get into the content here in just a second. I will point out that Vanity Fair and a few other publications had kind of said, well, here's the real reason why this seemingly giant UFO story was given a miss by these big publications. Mm-hmm. What they seemed to fail to report was that, you know, Ralph and Leslie didn't just get antsy and just decide, we just, you know, we want to go publish with a smaller publication because you guys won't work with us on our terms. No, they were concerned that they were going to lose the story. And publications like that that were criticizing them for doing that also failed to note the publicly available information we provided on our own vetting process underlying this. And so once we were 100% certain that this was a story that we could stand behind, we were convinced by the reporters and, of course, the sources. Again, that made easier by the fact that unlike in previous instances where a lot of UFO articles over the years have, you know, quoted people on background, especially in the case of Mr. Grush, we had several sources that were on record. But with Mr. Grush here, we knew this guy had worked for the U.S. Air Force, the National Reconnaissance Office, the I think most recently the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. We were able to speak with former coworkers. We were able to confirm not only that he had worked in that agency and in the capacity as a liaison to the UAP task force, but further that he didn't have UFO interest prior to all that. He had actually been referred to the director of the task force based on his, you know, his capabilities in geospatial intelligence and, of course, the work that he did for that agency. He was referred, and then based on that, they recruited him. And one of the people, of course, who speaks to Grush's credibility was the guy who had been appointed to the task force on behalf of the Department of the Army, and that was Carl Nell, who also is speaking on record in this article. And again, he's another one of those individuals who we were able to independently vet. So it was really a unique circumstance, and a lot of people were talking about that. It's almost unprecedented to have all these people formerly having worked alongside the UAP task force or in direct coordination with it on the UAP issue, not only coming out and, you know, speaking on the record about these issues, but more fundamentally, Grush saying, I became aware of the existence of a program within the capacity of my time in government working on this issue. And this is something that he feels has been, information about this has been illegally kept from Congress and, of course, the American people, and that it's a huge issue. Now, that's, of course, the core claim that he makes, that we have craft of non-human origin. That is, by its very nature, an extraordinary claim. And I am no less troubled by extraordinary claims of that magnitude than anybody else, than any other science reporter or any kind of political reporter in Washington or whatever. But the thing that I think is really significant, and obviously people haven't missed it, but I don't think it gets as much attention as the primary claims he makes, which are significant. But what a lot of people, I think, fail to emphasize enough is the fact that there was this inspector general complaint, this intelligence community inspector general complaint. What that means in the context of making these claims as part of a complaint, an official complaint, supplemented by what he says are hundreds of pages of documents, classified documents that provide testimony from individuals supplemental to his core claims. What this means is that if Grush is ever found as a result of the ensuing investigation to have made false statements, he could be held legally liable for that. He could be charged. He could be penalized with criminal charges. So he stands to gain nothing from lying. And that's what makes this such a bizarre situation. And to me, as the editor who eventually was the final say on, you know, whether we would publish this story, and we chose to actually go to print with it, to me, the huge story here is this individual is making some of the most unusual claims we've ever seen related to an inspector general complaint filed within the U.S. Department of Defense. And if he is found to be telling the truth, the implications are huge. But again, he stands to gain nothing from lying. And that, to me, doesn't alone prove the nature of the claims, but it certainly gives us pause for cause and makes us think, well, I mean, is this necessarily as crazy as it sounds? Could there really be a there? Now, of course, after the publication of our article, he also did an interview that was granted to journalist Ross Coulthart. There were additional claims that were made there. A little controversy because of, you know, comments that Grush had made about pilots, you know, or the recovery of bodies and things like this. In fairness, that was never anything that we discussed with Ralph and Leslie. That never came up once. People have tried to kind of pin Leslie down about that. And looking at the interviews where she's discussed it, I mean, she's pretty clear. She's like, that wasn't something we discussed with our source. And the fact that he brought it up to Ross Coulthart, I mean, we can't speak to that point because that wasn't something that we discussed with him. I'll also point out, though, then I spent, you know, the full hour watching the interview with Ross Coulthart. Grush doesn't just come out and say, oh, and guess what? There are bodies. No, I mean, Ross prompts that. He asks the question, were there ever bodies? And the way that Grush states, well, you know, I mean, when there are crashes, presumably there are pilots. And so, yes, you know, there seems to have been bodies that were recovered in these instances, too. It didn't seem very sensational the way that he said that. It was obviously directly in response to a question that Ross had asked. And although, again, that is an additional layer, and I see why entirely why it's controversial. I also think that there have been some online who have pushed that issue and who have maybe made a little more of that than is really, I think, required in this instance. Not to say that we shouldn't be asking whether there are bodies or not, but I mean, people really are focused on, well, how come the original article didn't address that? Leslie seemed to have been very clear on that point. And certainly in our discussions prior to publication, we hadn't discussed that. So that everything from my perspective was completely consistent in terms of the timeline of when those claims originate and what, you know, how Leslie characterizes all that. So where does that leave us? You know, here's my take on this, guys. Grush has made extraordinary claims. We knew that from day one. They're very interesting. Again, like I said, he stands to gain nothing from lying about this. And that does not alone mean that what he's saying is true, but I've pointed out many times that even skeptic Mick West has said, I think Grush is probably telling the truth in the sense that he believes what he is saying, but Mick says further that he thinks that the claims that Grush seems to believe and is therefore making are probably inaccurate. That's the kind of thing you'd expect a skeptic to say, of course. But even Mick, and this is the point I've tried to drive home, and some of my listeners get mad when I quote Mick West, but I mean, Mick's spot on. It's like, dude, this guy is saying, a skeptic saying he thinks that Grush believes what he is saying. He, of course, as a skeptic, also differs on the veracity of those claims. But I have to point out again to folks, you know, when one of the main skeptics in this whole dialogue right now is saying, but it seems like he's probably telling the truth. Yet again, that's pretty significant to me. If it were to turn out, though, that everything that Grush was saying was actually true and verifiable, the question I leave us with here is, would that really be all that strange? You know, because, I mean, we've been hearing these claims for, I mean, decades. And again, that's why I preface this with Roswell, and there are other instances leading up to the present day where claims of, you know, crashes have occurred. We've been hearing about this for decades. So for me, if you were to come out tomorrow, you know, another whistleblower comes out and he contacts, you know, Matt Plunkett and says, hey, listen, or Josh Burton and says, you know, I've got new information, right? And somehow this was all confirmed. I don't think I'd be like, okay, my whole world is now shaken. I don't know what to believe now. No, I think I'd probably, if it were confirmed tomorrow, I'd probably go like, well, it's not that surprising given some of the stuff we've been hearing already for decades. Yeah. It's just, I needed more evidence before I would accept it and believe it. I still do. But Mr. Grush's development, we'll call it that, because we got to see what the results of this investigation and everything will be. But I mean, this development involving Mr. Grush could be something that moves us in the direction of bringing all this to a new, you know, level of awareness on the public within Congress, and therefore potentially confirming a lot of suspicions we've had for a long time.
So you said a couple things there that I wanted to point out on, and I'm glad you covered not only David Grush's claims, but the mindset that followed from people, especially that were skeptic about it. Because I was checking out your episodes on the Micah Hanks program, the June 5th and June 12th episodes. And I'm glad that on the 12th one, you touched back on those details about why people think he's exaggerating, or a skeptic's point of view, like Mick West, or, you know, A through Z. I'm glad you touched on those. But I'm curious, do you think him coming out at this time has anything to do with the that Intelligence Authorization Act that talked about how whistleblowers would be okay if they did something like this? Do you think perhaps he's thought about this for much longer and thought, now's my time? Or do you think it's just consequence that it just happened and he's like, oh, hey, no, perfect timing. Why not just step out the door and tell him what I've seen or heard?
I don't think there's any coincidence that, I mean, the provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act for 2023 outline a whistleblower protection, a mechanism through which whistleblowers can come out and they can talk about these things. I don't think it's any coincidence that we hear from Mr. Grush after the passage of that bill. But I do think, as far as how far back does his knowledge go, that it doesn't go much further back. And the reason why is because he's describing events that occurred presumably only since 2020, or thereabouts. Maybe if he had been working in an unofficial capacity with the UAP task force, or even an official one, prior to it being officially sanctioned in the summer of 2020, it could have gone back further than that. But I'm presuming that his involvement probably began sometime after the middle of 2020, after the official public establishment of the UAP task force. Mm-hmm. And I guess that information is verifiable. I don't have that right offhand, but I bet that could be verified. And pretty easily, in fact, given that some former members of the task force have come out and publicly talked about what they did, what capacities that they were working with, the task force, and the general timeline of events, you know, leading up to, for instance, publication of the 2021 preliminary assessment on UAP and things like that. But that said, yeah, it seems that it was around that time, 2020 or 2021, that Grush would have begun working with the task force and therefore would have come into knowledge of this information from other government insiders who, he says, informed him. Now, let's be clear about a few things here. As Grush has said since day one, and as was reported in the article that we published at the debrief, he said that he's not seen these craft himself. He said that he, you know, has not been around these things or has not been shown physical evidence supporting them. He does say that he has seen some interesting things, you know, I guess the implication being imagery and things like this that seem to support some of the facts that he's been presented. That's not unusual given the fact that there are a lot of people who work with the task force and people who have worked in government over the years who have said that they have been shown imagery, you know, photographs and other things, documentation that supports a deeper level of information about UAP being collected by the government. And here's one of the issues that we actually see with this. You know, if we go back in time and we look at, for instance, there was an organization in the Northeast back in the 1970s and 80s that was called the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, CAUSE. With the still relatively new, I mean, only a couple of decades old, the Freedom of Information Act at that point, with the fairly newly accessible Freedom of Information Act and the ability now for UFO researchers to file these requests with government about information that they possess on a range of issues, but UFOs being one of them, CAUSE went to work trying to get information from the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. They were successful getting a bunch of UFO documentation from the FBI. I think those were first obtained by researcher Bruce McAbee, who is a longtime researcher, but also an optical physicist. Then there was the CIA UFO files that CAUSE obtained. Then they went after the NSA, and the NSA had been the most difficult agency to work with in this regard, because what they essentially did was they appealed to a district judge on that FOIA request and said, look, it is in the interest of national security that this information is not released. And here's why. And they list all the reasons, you know, that protecting their ways and means, their sources and methods and all this stuff. They say, you know, if there are frequencies that are being operated by our intelligence gathering apparatus, and in order to reveal the UFO information, we reveal some of those sensitive equipment capabilities, our enemies may be able to spoof us by replicating those kind of things. That's one example. And so they basically said, we need you to understand that the public interest in UFOs does not outweigh the protection of national security. Long story short, the judge said, yeah, I agree. You know, and he ruled in favor of the NSA on that one. And that kind of sucked, because in that regard, I mean, we were close to seeing some of the probably the best UFO information that's been collected by one of our intelligence agencies. Once the CAUSE FOIA request was shut down, future attempts to try and obtain NSA documentation have resulted in the NSA simply saying, we don't have any documents on UFOs, which seems to suggest that they were either destroyed, removed, compartmentalized, renamed. Who knows what might have happened there? But a great example is, you know, the intrepid researcher John Greenwald of the Black Vault. John has repeatedly tried to get access to any information the NSA has on UFOs and has been told we don't have any. Now, we know that they had some and that it was considered sensitive enough that it wouldn't be released even by the judge who was overseeing that case based on the NSA's argument back in the early 80s at that point. You know, we know that there were documents that existed then. The fact that they would say they have none now, yeah, that stinks to high heaven. Mm. But I say all that because if we look at the current efforts of the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, you know, ARRO is currently the DOD's unit that is tasked with investigating UAP as directed by Congress, okay, in the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act. And some of the priorities and powers were expanded in this most recent one, that version of the bill that included also that whistleblower protection. And what, in likelihood, yes, back to your question, prompted Grush to come forward at this time. But during the recent Senate hearings led by U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, again, the one who spearheaded that effort to get that amendment into the NDAA, you know, she's sitting there talking with the director of Arrow, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, and he's saying, we currently don't have Title 50 authority. Now, what this means is, basically, they don't have access, Arrow, to all of that sensitive information on UFOs that intelligence agencies like the NSA and the CIA have collected on this topic. They don't even have access to that. So if we think about the fact that Grush is saying, well, while I was a member of the task force, there were other people in government, in the intelligence community, that, you know, they told me about these kind of programs and how we were collecting stuff. A lot of people are like, okay, that sounds kind of fishy because you work with a UAP task force. You should have had access to all this information. And you say that there were other government insiders telling you about stuff that you and that Congress didn't know about. I don't find that hard to believe at all because, I mean, Sean Kirkpatrick sat there giving testimony before the Senate earlier this year saying, my unit, Arrow, doesn't have Title 50 authority. We don't get access to all the stuff, you know, that the CIA and the NSA and others have collected. So this has been an ongoing issue with government. And, you know, even though it's come up in recent dialogue with friends of mine in the scientific community, to what extent the UAP task force might have actually had those, you know, authorities and accessibility. I go back to a political article from like 2020 or 2021, where Chris Mellon was quoted by journalist Brian Bender. And he was basically saying that officials he knew within the UAP task force claimed that they were, quote, being stiff-armed by the intelligence community. In other words, the intelligence community, when asked to provide information they had on UAP to the task force, these intelligence community groups were non-compliant. They refused to give that information to the task force. So the fact that somebody allegedly might have told, and according to Grush, did tell him about programs that were outside the authority of the UAP task force and now are presumably outside the authority of Arrow, not surprising to me at all. But further, I'll point out, people have, again, and this is hilarious to me, people went to the Pentagon and they got a statement from Susan Goff, who's basically the person who handles public affairs. I've communicated with Susan many times in my official editorial capacity and as a, you know, just as a journalist, a science writer for the debrief. The quote that was given to everybody was that Arrow has no knowledge of any such programs that Mr. Grush claims to have heard about. And I'm thinking, well, why the hell would they? They don't have Title 50 authority. They couldn't. It sounds like Grush is talking about something that falls well outside the authority of anything Arrow has access to. And if they have heard anything about this, the only place they would have heard that would have been from people like Grush, who presumably have testified before Arrow, and others who may also have presented such claims to them. But if Kirkpatrick and Arrow say that they don't have any evidence of things like this, the way I read that is, well, we have not been granted explicit access to information that officially proves the existence of such programs. What I suspect they're not talking about is what certain whistleblowers like Grush probably have provided testimony about and which they are still currently investigating. Same extends to the possibility of whether anything that points to extraterrestrial technologies may have been observed. Definitely some weird stuff in Arrow's holdings. I mean, they've got more than 800 reports at this point. But I think that they're going to be super cautious before they come out and definitively say, okay, folks, we have now detected an object that we saw coming with our sensors into Earth's atmosphere from space and then exiting, and it was technological in origin. I mean, I think we got a long way before they'll ever get to a point where they feel comfortable saying things like that if they found that. But the idea that Arrow would not be aware of the kinds of programs Grush is talking about makes perfect sense based on everything that has already been said, right? And as I point out, the history, the deeper history of this topic going back to the 70s.
I completely agree with you on that.
Well, you damn well better.
So I recently also heard that was the House of Representatives that was just recently talking since Grush came out about holding another hearing about UAP transparency.
Yeah, and it's also interesting that, you know, you've been hearing, I even saw on Twitter this morning, Five Eyes was trending. What that means is, you know, basically the five, you know, nations, US, Canada, UK, Australia, New Zealand, I believe, I think, and who else? I'm missing one there too. But the Five Eyes nations are now sharing information that they have.
Interesting.
That they're collecting on UAP.
I think I saw something about Canada talking about that.
Well, there was a big memorandum that came out in recent days. This is a big issue right now. Yes, Canada, there was an official who had appealed to the the newly appointed defense minister there in Canada, alleging the same thing, that Canada may also be in possession of these craft of non-human origin. which is fascinating to me because now it's not just one lone claim from a single individual in the U.S. government. Now we have similar claims that, again, it's fairly early in the game, but I mean, similar claims are now coming out of Canada. We could, and I'm speculating here, we got to wait and see where this goes, but I mean, we could potentially be looking at the beginning of a domino effect where other nations do start coming out and saying, you know, the U.S. whistleblower has, you know, raised some questions about things, and here's what our country knows about this. Countries that I say we should be keeping an eye on because they have perhaps a greater history of transparency on some of these issues than the U.S. does. Mm-hmm. France would be one to look at. That would certainly be a country I would be keeping an eye on because earlier this year, in fact, they have held a couple of aerospace conferences that are dealing with this topic. Our French correspondent, Baptiste Friscourt, has actually done a couple of excellent articles for the debrief about that. One we published just this morning. So,
I'll be damned.
I would keep an eye on France, and again, we'll see if anything else comes of this, but indeed, it seems that some in Canada are concerned now about the level of transparency on this issue that Canada's government has shown in recent years.
Interesting.
So, one thing about this whole ordeal that I find very interesting is the supposed, like, separation of ideas when it comes to non-human intelligence, non-human origin, being somewhat related to the idea of whatever, you know, a human would consider what an extraterrestrial really is. So since, especially in that interview with Coulthard, is that mm-hmm. his name? Yeah.
You got it.
Him talking about, so you're saying there's extraterrestrials here? He goes, non-human intelligence, non-human origin. He's not saying extraterrestrial definitively. So right. It makes me wonder really what he thinks they could be. And I'm interested what you think it could be.
Yeah, it's that phrasing that always sticks out to me. It's the non-human intelligence.
I've never really heard it put like that. Like, you saw aliens? Like, well, I don't know if it was an alien, but I know it was non-human. It's like, well, then what the fuck was it? Was it a wombat with a cape? Like, give me some help here.
Or interdimensional beings.
I love those wombats with capes. But, you know, for me... alien might be the more appropriate term than extraterrestrial in the sense that alien would only seem to denote something that we perceive as not being human or of this world. Extraterrestrial pretty definitively implies something from another planet, something from outside Earth's atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Now, some would say, well, what's the difference then between alien and extraterrestrial? I mean, you're talking about the same thing. Again, to me, alien leaves open the possibility that outside this planet, or perhaps something that's from another dimension, or perhaps something that, you know, is the way that we perceive the operators from outside the matrix when they interface with our reality through the simulation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, what we're talking about, and that was an interesting point to me as well, the way that Grush is very careful to characterize them as non-human intelligence. Craft of exotic origin, clearly structured craft that were built by non-humans, but we ain't calling them aliens because we cannot with certainty. And again, I just made this whole point about my distinction between extraterrestrial and alien, but to Mr. Grush's point, the terminology he uses, as you pointed out, and as I just illustrated, is non-human. He preferentially chooses that language so as to explicitly describe this as being non-human, but without making any claim that it is of extraterrestrial origin. Now, that is interesting because it seems to suggest that we are, and Grush seems to even directly imply this, state it in fact, that these objects are of unknown provenance.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of people are saying the aliens are here, extraterrestrials are in our midst. And again, we've got to point out, the claims Mr. Grush has made so far do not entail the claim that extraterrestrials are here on Earth. That is one possible, maybe even a likely interpretation of some of the alleged phenomena that he describes and the acquisitions by the United States government. But he is very clear and cautious in the way he words that so as to make certain that he says, these aren't ours, but we don't know where they're from. Now, that's a really interesting point because, again, I mentioned simulated beings or, you know, beings from outside the so-called matrix. You know, that's an interesting one that doesn't get enough attention. But, I mean, again, just think about this. In the Matrix films, Mr. Smith, right, Agent Smith, He looks like a MIB, but what he really is he is one of the computer intelligences interfacing with humans within the Matrix, right? Yes, that's completely a nod to the films, but I mean, it's an interesting possibility in the broader scope of what UAP might be. There have been a lot of proponents of the so-called interdimensional hypothesis of UAP over the years. Another notion is that UAP might represent time travelers, and that with no need for extraterrestrials, beings which might be humans, but they don't look like humans per se, so they probably are something more akin to a evolutionary form of humans further on down the road. My colleague, Dr. Michael P. Masters, has done a tremendous amount of work about this in this area with what he calls the extratempestrial model, but the notion that time travelers in the future may be coming back and visiting us in current times, and our interactions with UAP may represent those interactions. Extraterrestrial is another one. Then there's, again, what John Keel would have called ultra-terrestrial. A lot of people, I think, are fuzzy on what that meant, but there had been an actual definition that he provided on a index card for a kind of a dictionary of the anomalous that he was composing. And the way that John kind of described his notion of an ultra-terrestrial was really a being who, whether or not they're from our reality, they interface with our reality and they exist alongside us here on Earth, but they are not humans, right? A similar idea had been proposed by the late researcher Mac Tonies in an excellent book that he wrote a number of years ago called The Crypto-Terrestrials. And that was the term that he had for this. The notion that there could be some sort of an intelligence from right here in our midst that somehow is kind of like a breakaway civilization, a civilization maybe that is sort of existing alongside us, but which is not us, right? Now, these are all entirely speculative, and there are some people who really get burnt out on all the speculation, and they say, look, you know, time travelers, crypto-terrestrials, ultra-terrestrials, interdimensionals, whatever. That stuff is all less likely than just good old-fashioned E.T. flying here in Tic Tacs. Okay. To each their own, but again, something that I think a lot of folks miss about the scientific process, and again, for the real hardcore, super skeptical scientists, any discussion of any of this would be nonsense. I disagree with that point, but I also understand that if we want to phrase seemingly crazy ideas like this in terms of science, we can't lead with presumptions about what the phenomena we observe is if we do not explicitly know what it is, where it's from. So, all of that to summarize, I think Grush really does a good job being careful about ascribing agency or provenance while framing it in such a way as to clearly indicate this is not ours.
I think you're exactly correct. I love the way how he articulates, how he structures exactly how he's going to speak. I think that's a pretty incredible job on his part. With him and Leslie and Ralph breaking the story in 2017, breaking this story on your publication site, The Debrief, there's a lot of just credible sources going around, and clearly you can see this changing dynamic in the world of UAPs within the past decade, all just from a handful of people. So as Mick West put it, you know, I believe that this gentleman is believing exactly what he is saying, but there is talks in the midst of that about it being either misinformation or disinformation. Now, on that obscure line, where would you fall? Where does your head go with that? Do you think that he's more so believing what someone else is telling him and he's just kind of reiterating in one way? Or do you believe that this is something that's, you know, genuine from him?
So those are some really good questions, and I think some definitions would probably be in order here. Misinformation could be and is when somebody is presenting bad information, but they may believe it. They may not know that it's bad information. It may be presented by an authoritative source and in a way that seems official and therefore believable, but it's just bad information. Disinformation, by contrast, is when someone knowingly presents false information, and it is important to make that distinction because Grush could be presenting misinformation in the sense that he's been told things that he believes, and he, in good faith, is presenting this because he believes that what he has been told is true and accurate. If it were disinformation, it would mean one of two things. Either Grush knows that he is presenting bad information, and he may have been directed by another individual, agency, or some other authority to do that. Or there could be a unique and confusing combination of the two, in the sense that Grush believes what he is saying, but it is misinformation, because although he believes it, the information is not accurate. But it could be that the inaccurate information was provided to him by a seemingly authoritative source as part of a, guess what, a disinformation campaign. And effectively, it's kind of like when you're doing math, right? And when you get into multiplication and you, you know, you're multiplying, you know, positives and negatives, right? And, you know, ultimately doing that, you're going to end up coming up with a certain variety of number with a certain value, irregardless of the fact that they have differing, you know, negative or positive values going into the equation. Well, same thing kind of applies in the context of misinformation from a disinformation source. If your primary source was providing you disinformation, it doesn't matter if what you believe you were saying is something you believed at the time you said it, you were still propagating disinformation, which is a concern. Now, right now, there isn't any data that is suggestive strongly that what he is providing is disinformation or misinformation. But I spent a lot of time on my own podcast talking about those facts, just because they are a interpretation. And I feel, as a journalist, that they are a necessary question, a series of questions that should be applied to this entire scenario, because there is historical precedent for the introduction of both misinformation, that happens all the time, and disinformation on part of government agencies, especially with relation to the UFO subject. It's kind of ironic. I was getting some emails from people after the last episode, not the last, but the second to last episode of my podcast, where I just went deep into the whole Grush controversy and tried to look at it from every angle objectively, right? Now, my ultimate feeling is that I sort of agree with Mick West in that I think that Grush is probably talking about things that he believes. Now, Grush, I won't go so far as like Mick says to say, but I don't think those claims are accurate. Again, I am fairly agnostic. I just find it really interesting. And I'm not going to definitively say that I don't believe what he's saying, because that falls outside the consensus reality that as a skeptic or anything else, I like to operate within, okay? I always get pushback for even coming close to seeming to agree with Mick on a point. But look, you know, when Mick makes a good point, I'm going to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Those who, of course, were, and I had people contacting me and saying, Micah Hanks, are you a misinformation or a disinformation agent? I'm serious. And I wanted to point out to him, because I guess a lot of people, you know, I wear a lot of hats. I do my podcasts. I play in a band. You know, I'm the editor-in-chief, the creator and co-founder of The Debrief. I travel around and I talk at events. I do archaeology. I do, you know, as you guys know, I don't really call it cryptozoology. I've kind of narrowed my focus to the study of, you know, claims involving relics, hominoid observations, you know, around the world. And I find that fascinating. And of course, UAP and other, I mean, I'm really kind of a scientific 4T, and I'm interested in all different kinds of anomalous phenomena in nature and how science can be applied to it. So I understand everybody out there listening, not everybody is going to know. You know, I think my things are making noise here. I'm going to silence that. I know that not everybody out there who follows my work is going to know or recognize all the things that I do. A lot of the people who are giving me pushback about trying to fairly weigh the possibilities in terms of what Grush might believe, what he might be saying, whether it's misinformation, disinformation, or just information, and it could be true and eventually verified. They probably, those individuals who were pushing back against me, they don't realize that I was the editor-in-chief who was the final word on whether we would publish that story. And that story was, of course, what was brought to the world. And we've since been, you know, getting coverage in the New York Times, the New York Magazine, Fox News, Vanity Fair, The Guardian, you know, Live Science, CNN, Newsweek. I could go on down the list. I mean, basically everybody covered this story after we did. So if that makes me a misinformation agent, questioning, you know, just talking on my own podcast about possibilities and potentials after essentially being the editor who was responsible for allowing this story to come to the world, but only as a result of the incredible work of Ralph and Leslie and their article and the, again, stellar journalism that they do, Ralph being a 40-year veteran of the New York Times and Leslie having been an investigative journalist who's covered this subject for decades. That small part I played, nonetheless, I think was significant enough to warrant that it was in the interest of my publication, and of course, I think with hope that the, you know, the UFO community, but really the scientific community, academia more broadly, members of Congress and others, that they would see this story, that it would be important to them, that we still see that there's a lot of loose ends that need to be tied up, but that this would be maybe a step toward a broader understanding of a phenomenon we've all wrestled with. I mean, I thought that was significant. And if questioning the guy after having played that small role in getting this story out to the world makes me a misinformation agent, well, I'll be a monkey's uncle. Right? Or maybe a taped wombat's uncle, I guess.
There you go. A triple agent. You can dupe the duped.
Exactly. Well, then may lightning strike me.
I
want to
take a thought on that. Like, I find it so interesting that you guys were like getting mentioned in all this publication and everything, and all this was coming to light, and now all of a sudden you don't hear anything about it because we have rich people stuck in a submarine.
Oh, well. And you know, to your point, you know, and again, my heart goes out to those people on that submarine. It's obviously, I wouldn't want to be one of the people stuck on that thing.
No.
At the current time that we're recording, it's starting to really look like it's unlikely that a rescue is going to happen. I mean, but I think we all remain hopeful. But all that said, you look at like all the political news, you look at all of the like, I mean, just stories that are just non-stories to me, but that have dominated the headlines this week, and mostly in the realm of politics, Josh, to your point. But the submarine's another one, and you know, there are other issues that have been reported too. I am a little fascinated that, I mean, the question of whether we are alone, whether there's a non-human, and this is the key term, intelligence in our midst, operating technological devices of unknown origin, that in some instances may have been acquired by the U.S. and other countries, and that information about these may have been withheld illegally from elected officials in democratic countries around the world. The fact that that story is like popular for like a week, few days, and then, you know, move right along, you know, look at the new menu down here at Wendy's, right? Mm-hmm. It's incredible. Humans' ability to just overlook the seemingly incredible. And to that point, I'll just, you know, share one final anecdote with you. When I called my parents, you know, mom and dad are going to the store and everything, and I was like, mom, dad, listen, you're gonna probably hear my publication's name mentioned on the news in the days ahead. There's some pretty big news breaking right now. And I kind of briefed them and gave them the Reader's Digest version on what was happening. My dad was the one on the phone. My mom was in the passenger seat. Keep in mind, my parents, who, when I was a kid, they supported me reading books about all this, right? And I hear my mom in the background say, I believe it. My dad says, that's interesting, Spud. That's my nickname. You know, he calls me Spud like a potato.
Yeah.
I don't know why he always has. But he says, that's interesting, Spud. Hey, listen, do you think you can give me a ride to the dealership tomorrow? Now, think about this. That was my parents' reaction to what many see as potentially being one of the biggest stories of the century, right? And we're fairly fresh into this century still. So we got a long ways to go, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we're only coming up on 25% of the way. There could be some real big stuff in the years ahead, folks. But my big takeaway was when we talk about, oh God, society would collapse, religion would fail, there would be, you know, market disruption. Nah, I'm pretty sure if we found out that we had non-human craft, people would be like, I knew it. I knew it all along. Now, when does Jeopardy come on? You know what I mean? It wouldn't be a big deal for them, man. So it would be a big deal for some people. And that's the thing is, I think that humans can handle it. In that great tradition of you can't handle the truth, to the contrary, yeah, I think we can. And I think it's time that we really get out and start talking about this. And this is of vital importance. This is maybe the most important thing I'll say. I remain agnostic, maybe even cautiously optimistic, with some concerns about certain things that have been said in recent days as this situation is developing. But if any of it's true, it is of vital importance that information that has been withheld from the public, if that indeed has been the case, and it has been withheld from Congress and the American people and the academic community, if these technologies exist, it is vitally important that broad access to the scientific community is made, that they are allowed to have access to this technology so that we can learn from it, so that we can assess it, gauge it, so that we can understand the implications, and so that as humankind, we hopefully can learn from it and grow with it, as opposed to being kept from it or potentially being impacted by it in negative ways, right? I think that we really need science more involved in any UAP developments that may yet unfold in the years ahead. I think that that is of vital importance.
I couldn't agree with you more on this entire subject. While listening to you, I feel like in some way, I'm almost listening to myself. And I say this all the time. I'm kind of just like, you know, sometimes, yeah, I'll talk to myself because I'm the only person that listens. Because
I won't.
You and I seem to be on like the exact wavelength. Like there is no misstep here or there. I think exactly how you do on this entire subject. I think science does need to be more involved. I don't think the world will just crash and burn like everyone expects it to. But I will say that, and I don't think I'm the only one that said it, but the, you know, we thought we had an understanding on how our planet works. And then we discovered microorganisms, bacteria, stuff like that. And that changed our perspective globally. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen with this, because if this does come out sooner or later, it doesn't matter. It's already 90, 100 plus years in the works. If it does come out, it'll be revolutionary, but it'll just make us rethink everything we already knew.
Oh, yeah. And advances in virology were revolutionary. The discovery of the fact that rocks really do fall from the sky, meteorites, that was revolutionary. I mean, the discovery of, you know, the theory of evolution and all of its many facets, you know, and formations. I mean, that was revolutionary. You know, any number of other discoveries, the invention of, you know, steam-powered machines, the discovery and the harnessing of electricity. We could go back through history and look at any of these incredible developments that were tremendous instances in the development of not only human knowledge, but also advancement of our sciences, our engineering, and everything else. But again, we would look at UFOs potentially representing non-human intelligence or extraterrestrial visitation as being something that just would fundamentally destroy society as we know it. Nah, look at the history of science. Look at the way that we've responded to similar challenges. I mean, think to the days before the knowledge that bacteria, okay, microscopic organisms, potentially lethal organisms, were hanging out on your hands, and when you didn't wash them, and you went into a ward and you were helping deliver babies, that you might potentially endanger that infant or that mother, that you, if you were in, you know, conducting a surgery, that you might infect the patient who's being, you know, stitched up or sewn together, you know, following a surgery. And you might, although you're trying to help that person, potentially unwittingly negatively affect them, maybe even kill them. If you had told people that before the age of the discovery of bacteria, yeah, there are lethal pathogens all over the place, and we most of the time have them on our hands. People, yeah, might have thought this is going to be horrific. Everybody's going to go nuts. What are we going to do? How are we going to react to this? Simple, man. Wash your fucking hands.
And that right? is how we will end this. Wash your fucking hands.
That's the whole thing. It's like, you know, it was a simple solution. And it was a tremendous advancement. It saved, think how many countless lives have been saved by people washing their hands. In truth, whatever the ultimate expression of the UAP mystery ends up being, I think that we will accept it, maybe more quickly than many have thought. We will adapt, we will roll with it, and hopefully we will learn from it.
I think you're absolutely correct. Micah, I just want to say thanks for coming on the show. I could listen to you talk forever. And I guess I'm probably going to when I just listen to all of your back catalog on your podcast and everything else. But yeah, where can people find you at?
Yeah, you can find me online at MicahHanks.com. That's my personal website. Of course, the podcast, just go to MicahHanks.com/podcast. And of course, the original reporting from the Debrief team and I can be found at thedebrief.org.
Where the news story broke.
Yep.
Well, I'll remember that day in 2023.
Yeah, you can use that now.
Yeah. And my fond memory of that will be a little different. It will have been running back and forth to my hotel room, making phone calls, working on trying to pull all this together. But of course, also in the midst of an excellent event that the two of you were at, we were all kind of there together that weekend and many of our dear friends. So it'll be a fond memory for me forever.
Absolutely. And thanks for the White Russian. I appreciate that.
Well, it was my pleasure. I hope we'll have another one together next time, gentlemen.
I hope so. When I just knock on your door tomorrow morning.
Okay. Well, I'll be up early.
Well, I know you're a busy man, so I'll let you go. Thanks again for joining us. And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Indeed. Sooner rather than later, fellas.
Yep, all right. Absolutely. See you, man.
Have a good one.
Who was that guy? How'd he get on our podcast?
Who was that?
So there you have it. That's the interview that we had with Micah Hanks. A lot of interesting details that he goes over. Man, he is just, he's like the epitome of knowledge, mm-hmm. everything he has. I mean, good Lord. I mean, if you didn't learn that the U.S. is literally nothing but acronyms by the end of this, then
yeah.
I don't know what to fucking tell you. But if you have any questions relating to this topic, Micah Hanks is the guy you want to talk to, for sure.
Definitely go check out The Debrief, check out his other programs, the Micah Hanks program, Sasquatch Tracks, all that. But more specifically, if you're here just for this whistleblower incident, definitely check out The Debrief.
Yeah, check out the articles on that. Some of the recent episodes, I think June 5th and June 12th, he talks about it on the Micah Hanks program. Russ Coldhart does an interview, of News Nation. And what else? What else was that? There's even posts on Reddit that have gotten people's attention. So yeah, this gentleman's everywhere.
Yeah.
Needless to say, it's kind of like when 60 Minutes broke that their side of the news story when it came out about the Nimitz and the Tic Tac.
Yep.
And like that, everyone was just like, "What the fuck? Why is 60 Minutes reporting on this?"
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what this is like.
Yep.
Because he went over in the interview all these other publications that were reaching out and, you know, more or less kind of copy paste, if you want to say it. That might be a little more disingenuous, but all kind of in some way or form retelling the story because it's a big fucking deal.
Oh, yeah. Like, if you have any kind of interest in UFOs, aliens, extraterrestrials, whatever you want to call them, this has gotten your attention.
Absolutely. But won't keep you too much longer because the episode's long enough. Micah had everything he had to say, so we'll leave it at that.
Yep.
And if you want to look at, you know, check out anything else that us, TFR, The Farthest Reaches, has done, you can go to our website, thefarthestreachespodcast.com. You can check us out on any social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, even TikTok. TikTok. See, look, I'm, God damn it. TikTok. At just TFR podcast. Some might have TFR like underscore podcast, but it's all TFR podcast. You can find us all there on the website. You can send us, you know, a form if you have your own story, whether it be about UAPs or not. And if you want us to talk to you about that, if you want us to talk about it on the show or whatever it may be, put our minds together and see what it could have been, email us. Make contact. That's the page you want to go to on the website. Make contact. If you just want to talk to us about how shitty we did for our first interview, that's fine too. Have at that. I'm here for it. You live and you learn.
Exactly.
You live and you learn that there are extraterrestrial wombats with capes out there.
Yep. Need that on a shirt.
Yo, fuck yeah, dude. That dolphin picture from our PsyOps episode that you found and posted. That is probably what's manning these anomalous craft, especially if they're coming from the ocean.
Who knows?
Now, if I saw that with a cape, yeah, I think I would take up Elon Musk on his offer and fly to Mars.
Yep.
Never be seen again. But anyway, reach out to us if you want to. Check out Micah Hanks and all his programs and his website, The Debrief. And yeah, thanks for listening. And we hope you guys are staying safe, staying healthy out there. And you'll hear from us again soon.
Yeah, and if you're here and you had no idea who Micah is or the whistleblower, thanks for being here.
Yeah. Micah Hanks.
Golden Strike Force, assemble!